The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to legendary actor, author, and activist Theodore Bickel, who's known to generations of Americans as the star of stage and screen versions of The Defiant Ones, The African Queen, The Sound of Music, My Fair Lady, and, of course, Fiddler on the Roof. He was even in Star Trek: The Next Generation. Mr. Bickel is featured in a new documentary, Theodore Bickel, In the Shoes of Shalom Aleichem, and his autobiography, Theo, has just been re-released for the third time. Stick around. From his lips to God's ears, apparently is not a long-distance call. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, brought to you today by Amazon.com. When you visit MrMedia.com and click on any of the links to purchase books, music, movies, gift certificates, or anything else through our Amazon link, you support this free video podcast. Whenever you need something else from Amazon, please consider returning to MrMedia.com to order it. It doesn't cost you any extra, and we sure appreciate the support. And don't forget, MrMedia.com has more than 1,200 celebrity audio and video interviews archived on the site. That's hundreds upon hundreds of hours free entertainment. Subscribe for free on MrMedia.com, and you'll instantly get an email every time a new interview is posted. You can also watch and subscribe to the show on YouTube, Vimeo, Dailymotion, The Realm Network, and Frequency.com. And if you prefer to just listen, Mr. Media is also available for free on iTunes, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, Podfeed.net, and Player FM. You can subscribe to any of those services and never miss another episode. Finally, you can interact with Mr. Media Interviews on all kinds of social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and more. Friend or follow us, we'll friend or follow you back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of musical accompanists whose sons grew up to be Spike Lee in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. What kind of introduction most becomes a legend? That's what I've been thinking about for the past week, knowing today I'd be speaking with the most remarkable man, a living legend of stage, screen, civil, and union activism, Theodore Bickel. And let me tell you, the task doesn't get any less daunting when you read his memoir, Theo, an Autobiography. Just his family's escape from Nazi-occupied Vienna would be enough for one book, or his full career as a rising actor and musician in London with an interest in social activism. But when he gets his first opportunity to appear on stage in America, Bickel's life has so much going on, you'd swear he must have cloned himself. Read his book, and you'll get intimate stories of co-starring with Humphrey Bogart and Katharine Hepburn in The African Queen, of sneaking into Greenwood, Mississippi at the height of the civil rights movement in the 60s under cover of darkness with an emerging young folk singer you may have heard of, Bob Dylan, of appearing opposite Mary Martin on stage in The Sound of Music for almost 2 years, of touring the United States as a singer accompanied by musician Bill Lee, later known as the father of Spike Lee, and of standing in a men's restroom line behind Gregory Peck, who told him, "I have seen Fiddler on the Roof about 5 times with different Tevyes. Yours was far and away the best." Nope, not intimidating at all. Oh, and he celebrated his recent 90th birthday with Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Jeez. Besides the third edition of his autobiography, Bickel is also the attraction in a new documentary film narrated by Alan Alda, Theodore Bickel, In the Shoes of Shalom Aleichem. Mr. Bickel, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you very much. That's a great introduction.
I appreciate that. That's very nice coming from you. You probably been introduced more times in your life than I'll ever introduce anybody. So.
And sometimes less than fabulously. I was introduced at a university in the South, which shall remain nameless, and the president of the university introduced me in the following manner. He said, "Ladies and gentlemen, you're about to meet Theodore Barakael. Some of you have heard it before. Others have did not. Those who have not heard him before are no doubt looking forward to hearing him tonight."
And a little bit of an accent there in the presentation. Little y'all?
Y'all.
Well, speaking of the South in some ways, while you are, of course, known far and wide as an actor and entertainer, you talk a lot in the book, and I know you made a career of standing up for the downtrodden, whether as a union activist or as a civil rights crusader. And as we speak, just by some sad coincidence, the United States is again in the grip of debate over police actions that each ended in the death of a black man. And I'd really like to start there, oddly enough, perhaps, for some people watching this, and ask you, has anything changed in the 50 years since you first journeyed into the American South in support of equal rights?
The answer is yes and no. There have been changes. Obviously, there have been advances. There have been incredible advances. Who would have dreamt that a black man would be sitting in the White House and be our president? Or that we have an attorney general still do, who's a black man. There are advances. And yet, as the French say, the more it changes, the more it remains the same. Unfortunately, and as the protesters in the street will tell you with their placards, we still have to march, and we still have to say, "Black lives matter." That is such a sad commentary on our world. And I don't know that a black person is by nature of being black being singled out for mistreatment, and yet it appears to be the case. I mean, a police tends to mistreat anybody and get hold of.
How do you feel about the way that the protests are unfolding now? There were at first in Ferguson, there was a lot of violence. And now we're seeing across the country more peaceful demonstrations. Even to the point of the football players who came on the field holding up their hands to show, right, you know, don't shoot. Has the form of protest, has it changed at all in 50 years? Have we evolved in that way at all?
No, and we are still learning from Martin Luther King, who in turn learned from Gandhi, that the best protest is a nonviolent protest. It's less flashy, and I was very gratified to see the father of one of those murdered boys, no, killed, I don't know, murdered, calling for protests that were nonviolent. It's important. It's important. We are a civilized people. Shouldn't forget it.
I saw in your book that you talked about being arrested in the South when you were protesting. As black and white, blacks and whites were protesting side by side. You talk about how you were separated, different cells for each, and that you were no more immune to violence against protesters in the jail cell than you were from the police out on the street. That the police made it clear that you were supporting rights for black people, and so the other people in the cell who were not there as civil rights protesters, you took a bit of a beating yourself.
Yep. Yes, alas, that was the case, and we sang all night across the courtyard to keep our courage up.
Did you ever think that we'd still be discussing these things today? Did you think then, you know what, we're going to overcome this? Well, of course, we shall overcome. We'll overcome this, and we'll move on to more progressive issues in 50 years.
I was hoping for it. I was not entirely confident that it would go away, and it didn't go away. It changes color, it changes a texture, shape, but fundamentally it's still there. Discrimination is there, race hatred is there, suspicion is there. And it takes different forms in different ages.
I imagine there's people who would watch this, and pardon me for the way I describe this, but they'll look at you and they'll see this older white guy, older Jewish white guy, and say, "What do you know about such things?" But the reality is, you were just a boy when you went from one day you were living in a relatively free country. The next day, the Nazis are marching and taking over your country without a single gunshot, and you were discriminated against there. It was like suddenly.
Immediately, I was a person, sure, I was only a boy of 13, but I was a person of equal rights, and immediately I turned overnight into an object of derision, of hatred, of persecution, and I saw incredible cruelties being perpetrated upon people I knew down in the street. Men forced to clean their sidewalks with their toothbrushes, women with their fur coats, men being shipped off in trucks to God knows where. And a lot of people that I knew suddenly overnight became lords and perpetrators, and yet others did not. Nice, decent people, but they didn't call a halt either. And I couldn't formulate it then. Today I can't absolve these nice Gentile people next door of guilt and complicity. And I swore that I could never put myself in the position of these nice people next door who think that when the victims are not of your own group, it's not your fight to fight.
Or it doesn't count.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it does.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that struck me in your description of that time was not so much. I mean, we know that the Nazis rolled into Europe and several countries without a shot being fired, but the thing was to go from one day you're a neighbor living amongst it's Jews and Gentiles living amongst each other. There were problems in school. You talk about that. Those were already existing. But to suddenly look out the window, see the Nazis coming down the street, and see your neighbors cheering them on. These people that, you thought were your friends and your neighbors, and suddenly they're like, yeah, come on in, get the Juden out. Just like, oh my God, that's the most disturbing part to me. That is the most disturbing image I took from that.
We were shocked beyond belief. And where did all these swastikas come from overnight? Obviously not overnight. They'd been in preparation for a long time.
Well, so let me change gears slightly here. You have lived, obviously, I mentioned that you just celebrated your 90th birthday. You've lived in so many eras, so many things that have happened. When you think about the good old days, I mean, I think of the good old days and I think, oh, that was when my kid was 10, 11 years old and was still respectful of her dad. When you think about good old days, what does your mind go to? When does your mind go to?
Well, there are several periods of good old days. When I was a small child in Vienna, that was a glorious time. Glorious time. A time when I learned how to be appreciative of literature, of art, of the theater, of music. A place also that permitted me to develop myself as a Jew. All of that. That was good old days. Then became... The skies darkened after that. And then there came other periods of good old days that I can look back on. My early days in what was then Palestine, which is Israel now, they were fine in a society that I appreciated, that I liked, a socialist society, an egalitarian society, built upon a kibbutz principle. Wonderful. That no longer exists either, and you look back on it with nostalgia.
I was expecting that you were going to say your time in London, just guessing from the way it read. It sounded like you had the time of your life in London.
Yes, because there and my love for the theatre really blossomed again. London and theatre are synonymous with each other, and it was a wonderful time. I didn't have much money at all, but I didn't mind. I didn't mind. I didn't care. It didn't matter.
You were at the center of a social circle that was about as widespread as anyone could imagine. People of all different religions, races, colors, professions. And you were at the center of that. You and your flatmates, I guess.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. All right. So again, skipping around just a little bit for time reasons, I have to say, it occurred to me I may never again get a chance to talk with someone who worked with Humphrey Bogart. So I have to ask you what you can tell me about being in that man's presence. It's such a – I describe you as legendary, and I think that's very apt. And I think that people think of a Bogart as equally legendary and such a presence. And I'm just wondering, what was it like as you look back to be with that man and working with that man?
It was an extraordinary experience because he seemed so laid back, so laconic, monosyllabic almost, until he got on the set. And then there was a full-blown performance, and I can't tell you to this day where and when it came together. It was a lesson that I've never forgotten. He was also very pleasant to be with, pleasant to talk with. We played a lot of chess together. We had some laughs together. This was no standoffish personality. He was a wonderful guy to be in the presence of. Catherine Hepburn, on the other hand, not on the other hand, she was an aristocrat, but she was also kind to all the people around her, as all good aristocrats are. It's like the good people in Downton Abbey.
And do you ever go back? I mean, I remember watching with my wife and daughter not long ago, The African Queen. Would you ever go back and watch a film like that? When was the last time you might have seen it, if at all?
Actually, they ran it last year at a special showing and a Q&A with me afterwards. So I saw it a year ago.
And what do you think as you look back on that young man in that film and know, oh my God, that was me?
Yeah, I say to myself, you've come a long way, baby.
Well, what I want to know is, I got to ask you, I'm looking at you. This is the wonder of these video interviews. You look like the picture on your book, which looks like you 20, 30, 40 years ago. You look younger than I am, and I'm 40 years younger than you. How do you do this?
I'm doing it without makeup, for one thing.
Okay.
I live the good life.
Okay.
I read, I sing, I enjoy music. I enjoy life. I am even a newlywed, which is great.
Really?
Yes. Yes, I married a wonderful woman just about a year ago. And all that keeps me well and healthy.
Well, congratulations on that. I will point out, I will not ask the question, but I will point out that you make a point in your book that, yes, there is sex after 80. So if you just get married, I will go to a term I don't use very often and just say mazel tov. All right, so a couple other people I'd like to ask you about in kind of a quick succession. We mentioned that you worked with Mary Martin on stage in The Sound of Music. By coincidence, she's also very well known as Peter Pan for so many years and so many productions. And by coincidence, as we're recording this, we're a couple hours away from NBC is bringing back Peter Pan tonight in a live televised production. What do you remember most about Mary Martin and her presence and just her personality?
She was a tremendous performer on stage. She was also not of this world. She was waited on hand and foot and they brought her in a limousine from a penthouse, and after the performance took her back in the limousine, back to the penthouse. It's like they took her out of a bed of cotton and set her on the stage and said, go, girl, go. And she played all these little people, but she never got a chance to meet any, so she played her memory of what little people used to be like in Weatherford, Texas, where she grew up. She was a very pleasant woman, very pleasant woman. But as I say, not from here.
Well, and you anecdotally tell some wonderful stories about her. You talk about her going down in the elevator and going out on the street and realizing, oh, I need that thing called money. Because right. I guess her husband was very controlling, either because he was controlling or because she really, it sounded like she needed that.
That's right. And then she went back. She went back to the apartment to get some money, and there was a new guy on the elevator, and they'd been in this building for quite some time, and the elevator started up, and he said, "What floor, miss?" And she said, "Take me down again. I gotta ask."
That's great. That's a great story. I love that. Someone else said, and I mean, there are hundreds of people who you talk about in the book, so I'm just zeroing in on a couple. And speaking of Zero, you talk about Zero Mostel, who, of course, played Shalom Aleichem's Tevye in the movie, and people probably best know him for Fiddler on the Roof in that regard. But you describe him as, shall we say, a very colorful man. And I wonder, what made him so, at the same time, charismatic and, in some ways, from your description, repulsive? I mean, how could someone be so different?
Well, he was larger than life. There was no stage large enough to contain him. He was, he was brilliant. If you saw him at the beginning of a run, and there was nothing better. If you saw him about a month later, the performance was full of shtick and stuff. Obviously, he got bored very quickly. And he was burly. He was somebody, you know, when he played Rhinoceros, somebody said to another actor whom I know, I said, you know, you got to go see Zero Mostel playing Rhinoceros. The man without the aid of makeup turns into a rhinoceros. And he said, I've yet to see him in a play where he doesn't.
You, what was the thing? I was. You talk about him, though. It seemed like people would see him coming off the stage, and if they knew him already, they would probably head in the other direction, that he could... He could be a little too much to handle.
Probably not for me. I loved him. I thought he was I found him to be a very good friend.
Your description of him made me think of John Belushi, which may be a completely wrong comparison, but I thought of Belushi as this man of immense talents, very charismatic and a stage presence, but in his private life, everything was to excess. And he indulged himself in everything, and I thought, I'd never thought about them the same way until I read your description. I thought there might be some similarity there.
Probably.
Rather than me pick a name, let me ask you if you could pick out one other person that we haven't discussed, who you've worked with, stage, screen, wherever it might be, who holds a fascination for you over the time. Who would that be?
Paul Muni.
Oh.
It was an extraordinary life, an extraordinary talent, and somebody who came from the world of the Yiddish theater into the world of the English-speaking stage and screen and acquitted himself brilliantly in both. I admired him when I was a boy, and I continue to admire him.
Interesting. And what about this? You obviously have been known for so many great roles and so many amazing productions. What about the ones that either got away or that you turned down, or that you were frustrated that you were never considered for?
There was some such, yes. And there were some that I managed to play, but I wasn't the original one. And second and third time around is always different, because you have to be in somebody else's shoes. And that's, while I welcome that when it's Shalom Aleichem, I don't welcome it when it's somebody else.
All right. The last thing I noticed before we started the interview was when I was just reading through some things, and I saw that Star Trek appearance. I had forgotten about it. It's been a while. Trekkies are, you know, they love to have knowledge. Is there anything you remember from working on that show that stands out for you?
Yeah. I was Worf's Earth father. And I had some terrific scenes, one of them with Whoopi Goldberg.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
It was really good.
You were playing, as I recall, you were his Russian adopted father. Worf, of course, played by Michael Dorn. Has that role given you a bit of exposure to a different group of people than you maybe from other parts of your career?
Fans, I get fan letters. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have you ever done a Star Trek convention?
No.
I'm surprised. Yeah.
I did one sort of mini convention, but that wasn't the one of the big ones.
Okay. And thinking about that, the one part of your resume that seems a little thin is television. And I'm as I'm hearing you and looking at you, I'm thinking, I'm surprised that you never wound up doing like a sitcom or a drama where you would have the job for 4 or 5 years, stay in one place. A lot of people turn to that later in their careers because of family, something you talk about in the book, that you were not, you know, you're honest about it. You were not as there for your children as maybe you would like to be, or maybe other parents were. And that's why a lot of, my understanding is a lot of actors will turn to the steadiness of television.
You're in one place.
Yeah.
It's not that I didn't do sitcoms. I did All in the Family.
But I mean, as a continuing job, you didn't. You never. Right. You appeared, but you didn't start. Was that not? Was it not offered? Was it not appealing to you?
Both.
Okay. Good answer. Did you ever imagine your autobiography, Theo, came out for the first time in 1994? It was then republished in 2001, 2002, and then again this year, 2014. Not many folks who write their life story in their 70s or almost 70s get the opportunity to update and revise it. I mean, does that surprise you that you've been able to do that twice?
Well, the first time the autobiography ended with a handshake of Arafat and Rabin on the South lawn of the White House. And then in 2002, a lot of things had happened, including 9/11. And when they wanted to republish, they said, yes, but write a chapter that would reflect what happened in the meantime, from the time of the first edition until now. Fine, I did that. And this year they wanted to do it again. They said, now that you're 90, can you look back on your life from the vantage point of being a 90-year-old? And what is there to be said about that? And lo and behold, there was a whole brand new chapter to be written, and I wrote it.
It's amazing. I mean, you know, to get to do that, update your life story twice like that, it's pretty remarkable. I was kind of reading between the lines, and this is a little cliche, but it seems to me from reading the book that you might actually be the person who can attribute your enduring life and career to literally wine, women, and song.
Yeah, it could be. Most of these three, mostly song. But I won't say no to the other two either.
Yeah, I've read the book. I don't think you've said no to a whole lot of. I mean, you're not flagrant in your stories about women, but clearly you have enjoyed
No, and it's not a tattletale book either.
Right, right. I don't want to imply that it is, but you've been married a couple of times. You've had a good life in London, which is what I referred to earlier. Okay. All right. So we have to cover the documentary, Theodore Bekele, in the Shoes of Shalom Aleichem. Whose idea was it to do this?
Interestingly, I wrote a play about 5 or 6 years ago called Shalom Aleichem, Laughter Through Tears. It's mostly about Shalom. I play Shalom Aleichem, play the author himself. I play his characters, old women, old men, young boys, this and that. I also play myself in the beginning and in the end. And it was a stage play, and I did it quite a number of places, number of times. And when I performed it in New York, Elie Wiesel came to see it. And his first remark after he saw it was, if this hasn't been filmed, it ought to be. Now, you can't film a play. There's no way to put a camera in front of a stage and hope that it makes sense. It doesn't make sense that way. It's maybe for the archives, yes, but nothing else. So I started to think, we have to go back to the drawing board and make a film that makes sense as a film. And then we told the story of my life as being influenced by Shalom Aleichem, the characters that he wrote, the character that he was, his devotion, his passion for the Yiddish language, is a passion that I share. My life in the beginning, it's the film starts with the Anschluss of the Nazis marching into Austria and confiscating all our books, especially the Shalom Aleichem books, and then turning me into a refugee, which in one way or another I remained the rest of my life, no matter what success I had or where I live. And so there's my life, there's Shalom Aleichem, there are the books followed us, the books came after me. And when before my father died, he wanted to know who's going to read all these. And I told him, I promised him I would, other people would. And I wasn't quite sure whether that's true. And then when he died, I needed a home for the books where they would be loved and cared for. And I sent them to Amherst, Massachusetts, to the Yiddish Book Center, all the way from Tel Aviv. And then when I worked on my play and on my film, I needed the collective works of Shalom Aleichem, and I called them. And the books appeared on my doorstep. So this whole migration of Shalom Aleichem happened, and it happened to me and for me in my lifetime. It's great, really great. And I miraculously was spared during the Holocaust. My life was saved, and I wasn't quite sure whether why or if I deserved to be spared. And the upshot is that perhaps because I can use my voice where other people no longer have one.
Were these the same books that your grandmother saved from the Nazis?
Yes.
The actual books. That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful story. I it's just amazing how some woman, your grandmother. Mm. Why do you think Shalom Aleichem's stories and even his voice still stand up a century later?
Because Shalom Aleichem wrote not only for the people that he knew, but of the people that he knew. The shtetl that was vanishing in front of his eyes, he kept it alive by writing about it, by writing what people said to each other, where they said it to each other. They sat on railroad trains in the third class compartment and played cards and made jokes and tricked each other and told truths and told lies. And he had all of that in his ear, and he wrote about it. And he wrote the iconic character, of course, is Tevye, the milkman, who is in every every man, and that's why he's so popular. You don't have to be Jewish to understand Tevye the Milkman. And his Tevye is a much more tragic character than what you see in Fiddler on the Roof. And I make a point of that, too, in my play and in my film. So, and he was beloved. He died in New York in 1916, and his funeral was the largest that had ever been seen in New York before or since. 200,000 people were in the streets, and that was just in the streets, because people hung out of the windows as well at his funeral. So, and his granddaughter, who's in my film, she was 102 when she was in the film, and she was 103 when she died, just a few days before my film opened. Belle Kaufman, who wrote a book called Up the Down Staircase, that was Shlomo Aleichem's granddaughter. She had a letter from him, which I saw, and it said, he wrote to her in Russian, but it was translated into Yiddish. He said, Dear Belichka, I'm writing to you in the hope that you will write back. And I want you to write a lot. But in order to do that, you have to drink a lot of milk. She was 6 years old. That's it.
Well, you know, if you're going to create a character who's a milkman, you're going to want someone to drink a lot of milk. I get that. Do you think that Jews and Gentiles alike will still be celebrating and enjoying Shlomo Aleichem's stories another 100 years from now?
I certainly hope so. I think so, yes.
Okay. And it was interesting to see that Alan Alda is the narrator for the documentary, the play. My only connection that I'm making between you and he might be that you are both social activists. I mean, you're both actors, obviously, but you have a social concern and have spoken up on things that you believe in. And is that the connection, or is there some other reason?
We're also friends, and we were in a play together, actually, on Broadway.
Oh.
A play was a dismal flop. It ran three performances.
Oh, no. What was it?
It was called Café Crown. Yeah. You would not remember it, because nobody would.
Well, it's just, I'm thinking Theodore Bikel and Alan Alda. I mean, you would think they'd sell enough tickets for at least about a month or two, just based on the names.
He was still a young actor. The big star of that play was Sam Levine.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Well, interesting. All right, so last thing I want to ask you. If you could have one do-over from your life and career, whether it's personal, professional, whatever it might be, one thing you could do over the whole 90 years, what would it be?
Nothing.
Boy, I'm 54 and I can think of about a half a dozen things I'd like to do over. That's good. That's very good. Well, folks, listen, you can find Theodore Bikel's amazing memoir, Theo, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can pre-order it right, or you can order it right now, I should say, at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching the show on MrMedia.com, you know how this is. Somewhere below our video, either over there or over there, you'll see a copy. You'll see the cover of the book. You can click on it right now, and Amazon can get it to you in 30 minutes or less via drone, or more traditionally, you can probably get it electronically downloaded, or you can have it in a day or two in a physical copy. And also, the same goes for the documentary, Theodore Bikel in the Shoes of Shlomo Aleichem. Mr. Bikel, I see that you have a website. It is it theodorebikel.com, or is it Theo Bikel?
Bikel.
It's just Bikel.com. Okay. And do you have you been drawn in by any social media? Are you on Facebook or Twitter or any of that kind of thing?
I'm also on Facebook. I don't quite know how to work it properly, but people show me.
Very good. Very good. Well, Mr. Bikel, it's such an honor and a pleasure to have met you in this way and to get to speak to you. I just thank you so much for joining us today on Mr. Media. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
to believe her. A bad idea to believe her. Turn up the stereo receiver. Turn up the stereo receiver.
Hi, this is Buzz Burbank in the Buzz Burbank Newsroom, preparing for you another Buzz Burbank News and Comment. Do you like good stories? Boy, I sure do. I turn over a lot of stones each day to make sure I don't miss the best ones. Sure, some make me angry, and some make me sad, and some make me laugh, and isn't that what makes us human? I'm proud of the fact that I pack more news into my 10 or 15 minutes a day than the evening news does in a half hour. It's a free podcast at BuzzBurbank.com, or you can subscribe free at iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or get it on any RSS device. It's like a newspaper for your head. It's Buzz Burbank News and Comment, another Realm Network presentation. Weekday mornings right here on the Realm Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the George and Tony Entertainment Show. Prepare for awesome mediocrity.
We're the Cousin Oliver of the Realm Network. I'm George.
And I'm Tony.
And we're a weekly family-friendly podcast about pop culture.
From our point of view.
At RealmNetwork.com. The George and Tony Entertainment Show. From the Realm Network.
This is Snake. Do you read me, Otacon?
Loud and clear, Snake.
Did you listen to the latest episode of the Gaming Marathon on the Realm Network?
Of course. They really know their stuff about gaming, especially that Usid guy.
Yeah, but that Chirac guy is a real jerk. I don't like him.
Regardless, the reviews are spot on and they tell it like it is.
That's for sure.
What happened, Snake? Were you spotted?
Nah, it's just Lowell Meltzer crying about the O's again.
Close call.
I better continue the search for Metal Gear, but keep listening to the Gaming Marathon each week.
You got it, Snake.
New every Monday afternoon right here on the Realm Network.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said that they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
What you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
These are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot. Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
Resistance is futile. It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights.